My sermon topic today is called The Time Is Now, and you might have noticed, as with the children, that it's a very heavily environmentally themed service today, and it's something that I'm very passionate about, and I hope to inspire you a little bit today. When I was a senior in high school, way back in 1991, which honestly doesn't seem so far away, I wrote my senior thesis on the devastating consequences of chlorofluorocarbons. Anybody remember those? Show of hands. Thank you. They were one of the main components of aerosol cans. Those of us who grew up in the 80s were most familiar with them through our copious use of hairspray. Unfortunately, our big hair was causing a large hole in the ozone layer, and this was stressing me out. All I could think about was that we would all die of skin cancer and burn up with the sun's intensified rays. Perhaps I was overacting a little bit, but this really did consume a great amount of my brain power at the time. I have no idea why. I, a typical Midwestern teenager, raised by very conservative parents, was so obsessed with the environment, but I was. Perhaps it was because growing up in Iowa, I was constantly deluged with weather reports and how it would affect the corn crops. And I'm not kidding about this. This is anybody else from Iowa, they will remember this. The evening news always had a segment relating the lack of rain, too much rain, early frost, late frost. Every single weather condition you can imagine was talked about. And surely the very devastating consequences they would have on all our livelihoods. I don't ever recall a weather forecast where they actually said, all is perfect and we will live to eat another day. Never heard that. So it was shocking when I moved to St. Louis and discovered that most people don't even give a second thought to the weather. Mostly they think of the weather in terms of, do I need an umbrella today? Or maybe it's a little icy out because St. Louis and Illinois, we get a lot of ice, but never in relationship to how the crops are doing. Did they not understand that our survival depends on the jet stream? It was mind-boggling to me at the time after being so enmeshed in this. Additionally, every science and biology class in school would talk about the rapidly decreasing topsoil that had made Iowa the breadbasket of the United States. My apologies to anybody from Illinois and Indiana, because Iowa really is, and that's what we were told. Still. And currently, though, the estimate stated that Iowa had gone from 45 centimeters of rich topsoil to just 15 centimeters of topsoil. And as added visual aid, many of the biology teachers would bring in a large jar and they would show, this is how much topsoil Iowa had. This is how much we were projected to have. Pretty soon it will be like this. And for a very impressionable child that I was, all I could think about was, oh my God, what are we going to do? This is bad, this is horrible, and the weather reports were telling me everything was bad. So it was a very intimate connection between what the environment was doing and what we were doing to the environment. On top of that, they also would talk about the quality of the soil and the miracle of fertilizers and pesticides, because as the topsoil was decreasing, so were the use of pesticides and fertilizers, which, you know, kept the crop levels the same. You know, they do serve a purpose. They do make yields much higher, but they also had the devastating consequences of ruining, poisoning the soil and the runoffs, poisoning the rivers and the lakes. So, you know, it's a fine balancing act. But as a kid, though, it did not take a great leap of my imagination to tie together that without soil, there would be no farms. Without farms, there would be no need for tractors. Therefore, my dad, who worked at John Deere, would not have a job. And worst of all, there would be no food. And I like food. I liked a lot of food. The connection between the environment and our well-being was very well impressed upon me at that early age. What really sealed it for me, though, was when I took a more active approach in environmentalism was when I went to Germany and Austria for my high school German class trip. Everywhere we went, this was probably in 1989, somewhere around there, 88, 89, there were special three-sided green garbage cans, one for glass, one for cans, and one for general waste. To my 15-year-old perspective, this seemed like genius. Why were we not doing this? This was fascinating to me. Not only one or two people were interested in this topic, like where I had grown up, but a whole country was behind these garbage cans, and it was mesmerizing to me. My second surprise was going to a grocery store, of which I purchased something, and then they actually asked me to pay for my bags. That was a second shocker, because in my mind, as a right of the consumer to get a free bag. Don't we always get bags when we go somewhere? And it was the first time I'd encounter a situation where, no, that's not a right, actually. If you want to use a bag, you pay for it, because this is actually costing us something. This is costing the environment, so therefore we're going to pass this on to you. It was a very eye-opening experience to me, and that's why I really will always be for travel, because you really just learn so much. I was quickly frustrated when I returned. Where to begin? I was just one person in a country that was not all that interested in what I had to say. I did what I could. I joined Earth Clubs, recycled, cut out the CFCs, had flat hair, talked to whoever would listen, but overall felt I was pretty ineffectual. The only reason my parents recycled cans was because Iowa paid for them, not through any sort of environmental activism. And that's really what a lot of Iowa was at the time and still is. Pros and cons to that, but you know, it got people recycling whether or not they felt a conscience to do that. I just couldn't understand why people didn't care. Didn't they want the best for their families? Didn't they want clean air and water? Didn't they want to continue to enjoy all the beauty and the resources the earth has to offer? What is wrong with these people? Don't they see how right I am? Perhaps my self-righteous lecturing wasn't the best motivational strategy at that time. Really though, there are a lot of reasons why people don't take a greater role in caring for the earth. Some of them don't see it as an issue. Some have greater priorities in their life. Others feel it's not their responsibility, or that science will discover a solution to all their problems. Today, though, I want to discuss another common reason. Many faith groups feel that our presence on Earth is just a passing phase. We are merely enduring our human form until we move on to heaven or some other plane of existence. With that framework, Earth is not all that important. We can pollute it, use up its resources, change its climate, and who really cares? Earth is temporary. It is only something for humans to use on their way to greater things. Because of this egocentric view, the Earth and all of its inhabitants have greatly suffered. It has been speculated that the next mass extinction is upon us, and human interference is leading the cause. I find this train of thought to be particularly depressing. Next to China, US is the greatest polluter of CO2. Carbon emissions are one of the largest causes of climate change. This is fascinating. With close to 80% of Americans claiming some sort of religious affiliation, this is a huge group of people that could have an impressive impact on advocating for the climate. Every major religious denomination has a statement on environmental stewardship. From Judaism, Catholicism, Baha'i, and yes, even evangelicals, the leadership within these groups have recognized that it is the moral duty of people of faith to take care of God's creation. Unfortunately, there is a huge disconnect between what is determined to be religious responsibility and actual action. As Unitarian Universalists, it is part of our seven principles, which is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We come from a long tradition of environmental stewardship, and that makes me very proud. We need to continue to step up that effort and be a positive role model for other denominations who are only beginning the process. Whether your faith is in a god, goddess, or the energy of the universe, we have a moral obligation to take care of each other and our environment. I recently participated in a panel discussion regarding the need for Ameren, which is the energy company on the Missouri side, to transition from coal-fired plants to clean energy. This event was sponsored by Metropolitan's Congregations United and was held at a South St. Louis County church that was being directly affected by the pollution from the Merrimack coal-fired plant. It was to be an informative evening to not only discuss the plant, but to also discuss the moral and faith-based dimension to it. Unfortunately, the audience chose to debate the scientific merit of the arguments and then completely ignore any sort of faith-based moral reasoning. As entrenched audience members continued to drown out the panelists' efforts to be neutral and to only share the facts, it became painfully aware to me how far we still need to go, both in scientific and religious understanding. It boggles my mind that even though 90% of the world's scientists agree that the climate is changing and that is most likely caused by humans, there is still a significant portion of the US population that continues to deny that it is happening. Whether or not you agree with the science, you know things aren't like they used to be. One just needs to look around and see the increase in droughts and floods, superstorms, severe weather, and to realize something is different. When I was in school, we often talked about the precautionary principle, which is even if there's a remote chance that something might be true, precautions should be taken. What is the worst that will happen? Our air gets cleaner, our water safer, more jobs in the clean energy sector, food that we feel safe eating that is not destroying the ground on which it's grown. None of these sound tragic to me, and all seem very worthwhile goals. Putting the science aside, though, as people of faith, it is the ethical duty to take care of each other. The people most affected by climate change will be the ones least able to adapt. Most of us are fortunate to be able to afford air conditioning, heat, insurance, and the eventual higher food prices. This is not the case for everyone. We have all heard the stories of folks afraid to turn on their air conditioning or heaters due to the costs and then have suffered tragic consequences. As we see through our fourth Saturday lunches, there are many food insecure families within our communities. Climate change will only exacerbate these conditions. Scarcity and costs will only increase, and the most vulnerable will be the ones who suffer the greatest. As I speak, there are whole islands disappearing with their populations being forced to relocate due to rising ocean waters. Imagine all of Manhattan having to move. That's what's going on. We have a moral duty to help our brothers and sisters. Combating climate change is one important step in the process. As Unitarian Universalists, many of us already take significant steps to be more environmentally friendly. We recycle or use public transportation, we garden or utilize solar panels, and try to reduce our consumption. We do what we can, but is it enough? I currently help run Missouri Interfaith Power and Light, as Mary noted in the beginning. It is the state affiliate of the national group Interfaith Power and Light, and it is not a utility company. It's often confused for that due to the name, but it is not. Their mission is to help congregations of all denominations become more energy efficient through connecting their beliefs with stewardship of the planet. By coming together, congregations not only support each other in decreasing their carbon footprint, but advocate to help change on the national and state levels to be more environmentally friendly. While we are new to Missouri, many states already have very active affiliates. For instance, Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light helped organize a massive, faith walk, you would call it, in Louisville, Kentucky this summer during General Assembly. I was part of that. It was about 2,000 UUs all marching to help bring attention to fossil fuel extraction in the Kentucky area. It was really powerful. It was powerful to see that many people, and other faith groups were also invited. So I think in the total ended up being about 3,000 people there. Illinois IPL, who works under the name of Faith in Place, provides extensive programming and advocacy for Illinois congregations, and they are really a model. They're one of the earlier founded groups, and they're a model program in the fact that they just provide extensive help and programming, mostly in the Chicago and Springfield area, but they're willing to help out everywhere. I was lucky enough to hear their executive director speak, Claire Butterfield, at a district assembly that was in St. Louis probably 6 or 7 years ago. And after I heard her speak, I'm like, why are more people not doing this? And it's been a long road to get us going in Missouri, but we're finally here, yay. This past fall, Missouri IPL, which I participate in, we sponsored a faith walk along with the Sierra Club and some other religious groups, and we had a walk down by Ameren's headquarters protesting their use of the coal fire plants and asking them to transition to clean energy. We're not asking them to shut down, we're just asking them to think about where their source of their energy is coming from. And it was a very well-attended event. The National IPL offers many programs to assist affiliates and congregations in their greening efforts, such as Cool Congregations, which is a program to help increase energy efficiency. We are not the only ones in an older building. It's often very hard to increase your energy efficiency in a building that's older. So we run programs to help people do that, and the National IPL also has a Cool Harvest program, which encourages people to eat locally, because food systems are a very integral part of climate change, and eating locally is one of the best things you can do. Additionally, last weekend and this weekend, congregations all across the U.S. are participating in a national preach-in to combat climate change. All of us are preaching on the same topic, hopefully galvanizing people to to stand up and make a change. This is just the beginning. As more and more faith groups start making the connection between human behavior and religious duty, real change can be made. We are at a turning point in human history. We can continue on our current path or seek new ways of living. Nobody is claiming this will be easy. I shared that one summer I was committed to hanging all my clothes outside to dry, which many people already do, but I had not done. And it's work. It's not easy. It requires planning. But it was worth it. It was worth it in the end. Not only in my energy bill was dramatically decreased because I'm a household of five, and the amount of laundry is pretty tremendous, but it just felt right. And it was one small step that I could take and that a lot of us could take too. We are currently on the easy path, but it really will be ending soon. Together though, through supporting each other's efforts, we can forge a new way, a way that protects all of Earth's inhabitants. In your order of service, you will find a postcard I think most of you already saw. While I understand the wording is not typical UU wording, it is wording that captures a lot of denominational groups, and that's why creation care maybe isn't the first choice of words you would use, but using creation care or earth stewardship, earth ethics, those are all jargon, I guess you would say, that it's used within this field, and they just happen to choose those phrases. But I ask you to please consider filling it out and mailing it to your senator. We are not the only church doing this. This is happening across the United States. And it would be wonderful to have senators' offices flooded with postcards from people who care, people of faith, and people trying to take a stand. So I invite you, and I believe I have more postcards somewhere, so if you need some more, let me know. Remember how I started the talk with the chlorofluorocarbons? In 1991, the ozone hole was getting bigger every single year. The outlook was bleak unless something was done right away. Thanks to the efforts of a vocal and loud group of activists, CFCs were eventually banned and phased out. And guess what? The ozone hole has shrunk to 2% of what it used to be. When we put our mind to it, we can make a difference, despite the odds stacked against us. Please be that loud and vocal activist. Make change happen. Take a stand and set an example. Only good things can come from it. Thank you. Thanks.